Welcome to the WARC Podcast. I'm Anne-Marie Kerwin, America's editor, and this is the third in our podcast series, Marketing Truths. Here at WARC, we've been advocates for marketing effectiveness for more than three decades. And what we found, thanks to numerous research studies, is there is a set of principles of marketing effectiveness that have been proven again and again to work. This week, we're exploring our third marketing truth, which is that creativity supercharges marketing's impact. In this episode, we'll be talking about how creative excellence correlates closely with effective campaigns. So, in the short run, creatively awarded campaigns grab attention and generate fame at twice the level of non-awarded campaigns. In the long run, creatively awarded campaigns are more likely to convince people the brand is better quality, thus reducing price sensitivity and creating connections between the brands and consumers. These links between creativity and effectiveness are enabled by the greater use of emotion in creatively awarded campaigns. Emotional campaigns are strongly linked to effectiveness, with effective campaigns scoring higher on positive emotions such as enjoyment and involvement. But it's also true that other emotional responses like empathy, fear, and surprise cause people to remember what they viewed. So my guest today is Jim DeLash, Omnichannel Marketing Director at GSK. Thank you for joining me today, Jim.
Hi, Anne-Marie. Thanks for having me. I'm real excited to talk about one of my favorite topics, creativity in advertising and marketing. I just can't get enough of this stuff.
So tell me how you got started in advertising and marketing and what you're doing now.
So I started way back in the catalog business, actually, and it gave me a great foundation for testing and learning about creative in print ads or in direct mail and catalogs that you could measure very quickly and accurately. And then I moved into publishing and applied the same kind of principles to magazine circulation and book selling directly to customers at Rodale. And then I moved into pharmaceuticals about 20 years ago, actually, with GSK, and have evolved into many different like kind of analytics and digital roles. But in the last, I say, half of my time at GSK, it's been on the marketing and creative side of driving, you know, emotional response generating advertising for both healthcare professionals and for patients and consumers.
That's terrific. Pharma is a category that I would say not a lot of people think of leading with creativity. The Grand Prix winners at Cannes tend to be more the McDonald's of the world or the AB InBevs, which are definitely more fun categories of advertising. How do you see creativity's role in pharma marketing?
It's funny. I think it's the same as it is in any other industry. It just, we have more regulations, but many industries have regulations. You know, I attend marketing events and many people from different companies will say, we had this great idea, but legal had to review it. And they're not in pharmaceuticals. They're in some other industry, almost any other industry. So I think sometimes we impose these limitations on ourselves because of the industry that we're in. But I think emotional advertising is as important and maybe more so in pharmaceuticals as it is in any other industry.
Here at WARC, we've been talking a lot about this new research project that was recently done by System One, the strategic consultancy Eat Big Fish, and marketing effectiveness guru Peter Field. And the study found that dull ads actually cost marketers more money. In the U.S., dull was described as a failure to obtain an emotional response. Those dull ads cost $228 billion more in extra spending from U.S. advertisers to achieve the share growth that you would have gotten if they had used an impactful ad. So given that pharma has a terrible reputation of having to deal with the things that the consumers see as dull, what are your thoughts about that?
I'm a big fan of that study. I think Adam Morgan's stuff is really good. I mean, Peter Field too, Lesman, all those guys are just great in the work that they've done. But the particular Dahl study really connected with what I think about what we do, where we've learned all along if the ads that we're running, and I'm talking now about marketing to physicians primarily, but it applies to consumers too. If the ads we're running are dull by that definition, we need much more frequency to generate the response that we need, which is kind of what the study also is saying. And we've talked about that for years, that the irony is the better the ad, the less you need to run it, you know, where you would think you'd want to run it more so more people can see it, but you do expand reach then. So there's a benefit. But we know that these ads that are more typical pharma, and we get talked into stuff sometimes by our review teams. It's not their fault. It's marketing's fault, because all of a sudden we have messages that are complicated and try to be inclusive of many different topics. It's going to make them duller because you can't like emphasize one point, which means now you've got to keep running these ads more and more. And you might eventually get to the goal, but it feels like almost under duress as opposed to under desire. You know, like the audience finally gives in and will click on something or go to a website or do something that we've been hoping it would do. It'd be a lot easier if we just had better ads to begin with.
Right. Yeah. I can see the trouble of trying to get something through a legal team as opposed to somebody who's thinking about it from a marketing point of view.
Well, just on that point, if I can just, you know, add to that, it's interesting. Over the years, what I've noticed is our medical, legal, and regulatory team that reviews every creative submission. And over the years, we are getting better. They are getting better at working together. So they're not the enemy. You know, they're not trying to, you know, reduce sales or anything. They're very collaborative, and they understand it many more times than not. They will say, all right, you can't say it this way, but you can try this way. And they'll give us some alternatives. Most of the time, the response from those review teams is not about a legal issue or a medical claim or something, because we know those rules. It's more about a subjective feeling of, hey, this might really upset doctors if you say it this way. And what we've got to coach the marketing teams to get better at is, yeah, that's the whole idea. We're going to upset some of them, but that's because they're not protecting enough patients by vaccinating them against a certain disease. That's our goal. And if some get upset by that, then so be it. More will get the attention and the emotional response that we're looking for of saying, oh my God, that's me. I didn't realize I should be vaccinating more, or whatever the goal is. So we've gotten much more collaborative and a better working relationship with the review teams, which only will eventually and now even lead to better creative that will have more impact.
That's so interesting what you're talking about, the emotional response or the emotion that you're causing being the issue, because I think when most people think of emotional ads, they think it's just the ones that make you feel happy or enjoyable, but there's lots of emotional responses that get people to react. And I remember you were telling me about how sometimes tapping into those other emotions is more powerful for the message you're trying to get across.
Yeah, so I'm working in vaccine marketing now, and it's a preventative product like insurance or, you know, some things you take to ensure your safety down the road. That can be a hard sell, because much of pharmaceutical advertising is dealing with a certain condition you have that you want to treat. Here it's trying to prevent it. So the natural emotion that you go to is fear, you know, and how do I kind of scare people? And we've had success with that. We've had one of our products deals with meningitis B, which is a rare disease, but it's debilitating. It can cause loss of limb, even death. And so one of the ways we approach that emotionally is have survivors or survivors' families come on to a webinar, or we use them in video of some kind or in print to tell their story about how they wish they would have acted and protected their daughter or son who then got meningitis B and, you know, had some kind of catastrophic reaction. So we can get that emotional story. I mean, we've had these survivors come to our sales meetings and you know, the room is in tears when they tell their story. So we're able to, you know, convert that into an advertising message that I think really does connect with the audience and helps them. One of the things we hear from physicians is if they don't see the disease, especially a rarer one, they're much less inclined to take any action. You know, it's kind of out of sight, out of mind, I guess. Not all of them, but some of them. And so when you can show them these stories and tell them these stories of the effects of this, even though it's rare, if you're the one that gets it, it's not rare, you know, so you never know. You can't predict it. So why take the chance? I don't want to get into a sell message there, but that's the way we try to approach it and make the emotional, you know, fear of don't let this happen to your patients kind of be the lead message in what we're doing.
Yeah. One of the aspects of the study, the DULL study, was that the functional and rational messaging was less likely to move consumers, or in this case, physicians, to take action, whereas the more creative techniques were better at capturing attention and better to get a response from the person you're trying to get to change or take an action.
I had this theory of the, like if you look at the product maturity curve, you know, and the early adopters will respond best to, like, at least in physician marketing, the logic, the data, the clinical information, that'll get the early adopters, and they see the clinical benefit. But as you start to go up the curve into the early majority and late majority and that big bell shape, I think that's where emotion really has to come into play, because they've seen the data and haven't acted. So that gets a small part of the market. The biggest part comes from the emotional connection that you can then make and say, here's why you need to respond to this. And at the same time, if it's a big enough brand that can also run direct-to-consumer advertising, because not all of them do, then you have that emotional connection with the consumer matched with the emotional connection to the physician, then the stories kind of fit together nicely. So when a patient goes to the doctor and, hey, tell me a little bit about this disease, and I heard there's a vaccine, they both kind of have that same emotional connection at that time. So I think there is something to do with the maturity curve, where emotion becomes more important the further into the curve that you go.
One of the things we do at work, which we've done through our Building a Culture of Creative Effectiveness report, is hammer home the idea that it's so important that throughout an organization, you understand the role of creativity and what it's doing for your marketing. Can you talk a little bit about how you've worked to get the idea of emotional ads and creativity through the organization, working with your partners and internally?
Sure. We have an annual marketing conference, an internal marketing conference that I've presented a couple times at. And we also have monthly events that I've presented at. So what I've used the creative effectiveness ladder. I've used a couple of chapters in that story to tell and then give examples. And then, you know, I've talked about the campaign brief and revised that process. And I've done other talks on just creativity in general and how creative is a factor and how important it is. Because typically, you know, in pharmaceutical, a lot of times you end up with like a blockbuster product that masks over everything. So you're creative, while you don't diminish the importance of it, it's not quite as necessary. If you have a superior product, it can drive a lot of business for a while. And then eventually you need the creative. So it's not quite maybe as critical as it is in a highly competitive market, although now we're finding ourselves in many more competitive marketplaces where you try to differentiate the product on clinical data, but also emotional and creative messaging too. Every year I send out the latest John Lewis Christmas ad to the team, and we kind of respond, hey, did you cry during this one? Every year I get it and I cry, you know, and it's just a way to kind of subtly reinforce the importance of creative. And I've told the John Lewis story internally many times about how competitive their situation was in 2009 and losing sales, and emotional creativity just changed everything for them. And they just went skyrocketing up in sales over the next 10 years. And people really seem to respond to that and get it. And so it's a combination of like big events throughout the year a couple of times, and then ongoing sort of subtle, just little reminders of, hey, this is a cool ad with a creative that, you know, got a response for this reason. So it's kind of both.
I remember hearing from McDonald's that one of the things they did was change their brief to agencies was to create what they called a feel brief. Like, how is this ad going to make consumers feel? That was the top of their brief. And I know you've talked about the importance of working on the brief. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yes, the one of the presentations I gave at our marketing conference a couple of years ago was, I called it the Isosceles Project because it was the base of the project was the brief, but it also led to new analytics and new levels of experimentation. So I didn't want to just leave the brief hanging by itself. But our brief process, we kind of revamped it. And it starts now with what we call a campaign brief, which I like the idea of a feel brief. That's a cool idea. But our campaign brief is very specific in, you know, 8 or 10 different categories of information that's being provided to the agency. And it's both the creative and the media agency, and actually the analytics and database agencies as well. So it's directed to all of them, because the response to that brief is something that I call Words and Music Brief, which is a takeoff from Eddie and the Cruisers movie from 1983. It's a fun thing, but Words and Music is a euphemism for media and creative working together. So the response to the campaign brief is a Words and Music Brief, which is the concept, the creative concept, why it will achieve the goal, but also the media or the channels in which it's going to run, because not specific. It might just say, let's say print journals or something. If it doesn't have to specify which ones, although that's helpful, because we know the mindset of the audience is very different depending on which channel they're consuming the information. So if we're going to go heavy emotional, we might want to stay away from like New England Journal of Medicine, for example, which tends to be more clinical in nature. We'll do a lot more video, a lot more putting ads on websites and things like that that are designed to get that in the right emotional environment. So words and music is really critical. Then we approve that. Then they go develop the concept further and develop the media schedule. And then, you know, the agency will take it and run whatever briefs they need to run internally to develop all the content. But that was a process that started with the Better Briefs initiative from a couple of years ago that showed how there was this huge discrepancy between the way agencies viewed briefs and the way clients did. And it was like, it's the same document, but 80% of the clients thought it was great and only 10% of the agencies thought it was great. And I was like, man, there's something wrong here. So we've got to try to fix that because I'm sure it was true for us too.
So more and more I'm hearing from marketers that there's this need to bring creative and media functions closer together. How do you see those teams working?
That's the essence of what Words and Music Initiative was a couple of years ago. It's a long and winding road to get there because sometimes it's the agencies are not sure who's in charge, who can make the decisions, but we really have to, we have to force it more. And, you know, it was one of the fallouts from all the agency holding companies buying up all these agencies and they split off media and creative. So I think media took the approach, especially with digital and all the data, it's much more of a quantitative exercise than ever before. And I always worry about that because while that's important, this goes to what I think the first episode in this series was about, effectiveness and efficiency. I'm a big believer in effectiveness first and efficiency second. If you get the ads and the campaign to be really effective, you can then become efficient. I don't think it can work the other way around. And I think a lot of media is about optimizing and optimizing at the micro level. Not really interested in that because that's not going to change the business, especially in our business that I'm in right now, marketing to physicians. They're not going to make a quick decision. So if I'm talking to you today about the benefits of our vaccine and you should start using it, there's a very small chance you're going to go, oh, sure, where do I sign? It's a process over time. So we start measuring things more at a cumulative effect of what we're doing. And that's the mix of channels and creative where it really comes to play. So I'm not interested in open rates on emails or click-through rates on banners. That stuff doesn't matter because a lot of times people are still affected by the message without taking any of those actions. In the end, I want to see, are they getting to the website to view certain content? Are they talking to sales reps as much as they used to or more? And ultimately, of course, it's sales, but there's these lead indicators don't have to be as precise as I think the media agencies have been heading toward.
So I know a lot of marketers, when they start down this road of building a culture of creative effectiveness, find that there are a lot of hurdles. There's a lot of internal selling that has to happen. What are the hurdles have you run into as you've been working on this within a pharma environment?
You know, it's funny. There are hurdles internally and externally. You know, it's not all that different. And it's more about a comfort level, you know, because I think most people agree when we start talking about the importance of creativity and emotional response and words and music and all these things, everybody agrees. I'm just not sure that they're committed to taking the time yet to put the effort in because it's a little bit of an unknown where there's a lot of other things that the teams typically work on, which have more of a track record. We know it's pretty reliable what the results are going to be compared to when you're starting to do something different. But that also leads, that's why one of the angles in the isosceles triangle is about experimentation, that I think you need to open up your mind and say, look, I don't know if this is going to work by changing the mix of channels for this message, but I can sure test it to find out. Because one of the things we've learned too is our media mix models tend to show impact by each channel on performance. But I don't think that's accurate because that's like the problem with attribution models. The last action gets all the credit. We know that's not true. It's the cumulative effect of all this stuff. So the example I use is social media. Like that's a whole different creative area, different requirements. Is it effective or not? I think the only way to truly find out is to run half the campaign with them, social media, and half the campaign without, and see the difference. And the, you know, accounting, you got additional cost, but maybe you get additional benefit. A model's not going to show you that. I don't think. I mean, maybe we can be convinced of that otherwise. I generally think you've got A/B testing is the cleanest way to prove that. And I think people are a little bit nervous about that. And it's more time. It takes more time to do it. But I think the benefits are there. So it's kind of that self-imposed barrier. We don't really have barriers with our review teams or any, you know, sometimes setting up a measurement plan. It's not really a barrier, but it's another time-consuming thing that you really have to think it through. Particularly like just on a vaccines note, it used to be a simple business. You sold doses of the vaccine into the physician's office. They used it or didn't use it or whatever. Well, now a lot of people, anybody over 65 can get vaccinated at a pharmacy and have it covered by Medicare. So that's great. And it's perfect for the consumers. It just makes the analysis more difficult for us on the data side because it's harder to get that data. So now the decision making is a little bit trickier. But if you think about all that stuff up front, you can plan for it. You also don't need to be super precise. You need a direction that, hey, I'm trying something here. And if you have a belief that this is really going to work for this segment and this creative emotion is going to get what we need in response, you can set up a measurement plan. It's time. It's managing our time is really the biggest barrier.
Yeah, the length of time is difficult when you're brand building versus that quick response that you get from the email opens or something like that. I'm very interested in how you approach this dual audience that you have, both the doctors and the consumers, because that's sort of a B2B versus B2C split. How have you used creativity to reach those two different audiences?
It's interesting. There's a couple points to that. We've started to use a lot more connected to TV in targeting physicians. So, you know, we know physicians, they see the same ads on TV that our consumers do. But now we target them specifically, maybe with certain ads, and then we can measure that. And it's been really effective. So it's and when I say that, it's an effective add-on to what we're doing. That's kind of the way I always look at things. By itself, any one of these things by themselves only has limited impact. But together, the messaging really, really drives much better performance. So we're running TV ads, and sometimes it's the same ad on connected TV, and other times it's the same message, but in different channels for the physician. So whatever the message is about, you know, efficacy or prevalence of the condition or whatever it is, we say that same thing in the same way now to physicians and consumers at the same time. And that's showing some nice synergy there. And, you know, obviously for a physician, you get much more into the clinical data in supporting evidence. The consumer just needs a little bit of that, and they can certainly research it on their own, but they're more likely to trust their physician. The whole goal there is get them in to talk to the physician and then educate the physician on the message as well. But we found that when we're talking the same about the product in the same kind of way, it's better than if it's slightly different or, hey, we're talking to physicians, they're much more clinical way of approaching the creative is needed. I'm not sure that that's true either because we're still trying to get their attention. And that's that rational versus emotional thing. It still works emotionally. So when we kind of keep the playing field the same for each group, it has better impact, more impact.
As you've been on this journey of building out this effective marketing practice at GSK, what have you found to be most useful?
So what's most useful are the presentations, I think, you know, and sharing data and sharing studies from work, of course. I mean, my only complaint about work is there's so much great information, it's hard to sift through it all and find, you know, and use it all. But like, it's terrific information. And I will often share snippets of a study or a study, you know, with the team and just say, look, there's a new way to be thinking about effectiveness or frequency or reach or whatever, or creativity, whatever the topics are. And I think that it's funny because I'm never quite sure if people read them or not because they don't often respond. But ultimately, they do make comments later that tell me that they're paying attention. So it's good. Then it's up to them to kind of take it and apply it to their own part of the business. But also, as I started presenting more at marketing conferences, it gave me a good way to kind of step back and think about what we're doing. Because the presentations I give at a conference, I don't specifically talk about GSK campaigns that we're working on, but just in general, things that I've learned and researched about whatever the topic is. And then I can come back and apply that to the teams. And sometimes I've made the same presentation internally then, and that kind of sparks some interest and gets them thinking a little bit. So it's ongoing. We're coming around that to being more open to different ways of doing things. And especially when you get into hyper-competitive markets. And I think branding, the other thing that I just wanted to mention, I know brand was the last episode, but like I think I can talk about brand now. In vaccines, it was never really a big issue. So like flu shots, you just get a flu shot. You don't even think about the brand for the most part. Well, other vaccines, you know, it started with COVID, actually, Moderna or Pfizer, even though those are company names, they were sort of branded that vaccine. Well, it's becoming more of a branding opportunity within more categories, which I think is a really good thing. Because then it's not just get this shot, but it's like, hey, this one has these benefits. This other one has these other benefits. What's the marketing effort to brand? And I think the more we talk about that stuff, I think it gets people to think a little bit differently about it. And we've had a lot of success doing that in the last year. So I hope that will spur more of that thinking as we continue to evolve and compete. It's funny, in pharmaceuticals, what's interesting is everybody knows in advance when a new product is coming because there's clinical trial data, there's investor meetings, there's ways that we know in 2 years the competitor's coming out with a product, or everybody, and they know when we're doing it. So it's like you can plan for that a little bit, and you can say, how do I accelerate what we're doing to take advantage of that in the market today, but then also be prepared by maybe building up the brand, knowing that there's going to be a competitor in 2026 or something. And like, okay, that's an interesting challenge. You're not surprised. So it's up to us to now build that brand and build equity in it for what it stands for. One of the best ways to do that, of course, is through the creative messaging that you come up with. And also, I mean, we're just starting to dabble in like Fluent devices and create characters on our pediatric vaccines. We have these, they start off as babies, and then they're like 4 to 6 month olds. They, as they kind of grow, they, you know, they're used more to kind of connect the dots of these series of vaccinations that kids get. And that's a good way to help kind of brand, you know, what our vaccines are, give them a little bit of an image. And I think we're going to see more of that as we go forward.
That's great. And you can definitely talk about brand now. That's fine. What would you say would be your advice for marketers who are in categories that have the hurdle of having to talk about a topic that consumers may not want to think about?
Well, what we do is there's a combination of like awareness of the disease or the condition, and then the solution. And it's funny, I was thinking about that and I thought, well, okay, you'd probably be rational with the awareness and emotional with the solution, but it could actually work the other way too. Very emotional about the condition. If you have this could be, you know, devastating, whatever. And here's the rational, logical solution. So I think we split those into two pieces, and then it's more about, yeah, you may not want to talk about it, but you still got to educate people. And in our world, it's about prevention. So yeah, I need to educate you about what could happen, something you may not want to think about. You may not want to think about shingles or something, you know, but it's like our message is if you get vaccinated, you don't have to think about it, you know. So at least we have the opportunity to kind of prevent those kinds of things from happening. If you're treating a condition that people have, I think the approach is the same, though. You know, explain what's the condition, why you need to take action, and then remind people the importance of staying on script. You know, like, I forget the numbers now. It's been a while since I looked at this stuff, but the percentage of people who get their prescription filled is not 100%. The people who continue is not 100%, you know, so it's like, it's way below that. And so, you know, there's a lot of marketing that has to go on and remind you that there's an emotional reason why you need to stay healthy or get healthy or whatever. And regardless of the condition, and I mean, that's why healthcare is so privacy concerned and so important, is like, nobody wants to know anybody else's and should know about other people's health concerns, other than we're trying to help you address it or prevent it in whatever case it might be. So it's a perfect case for mixing emotional and rational thinking in whichever order makes sense based on the circumstances.
That's great. Thank you, Jim. And I'm so glad that you joined me today. This has been such a great conversation, and I really so enjoyed hearing about how you're thinking about applying creative effectiveness to pharma, because I do think it's a category most people think of as almost being its own beast, right? But a lot of these effectiveness principles do apply. So thank you for helping us see that. I appreciate that.
I'm so glad to do this, Emory. I enjoyed our conversation. And yeah, I think pharmaceutical marketing is not that different from other kinds of marketing, really. You're still trying to convince a group of people to take an action that you would like them to take. And, you know, we may have a few more regulations than other industries, but not as many as you might think. And I think the principles apply. So whatever we're learning, if we can share with other people in other industries, I think there's a benefit for everybody. As we try to learn from other industries as well. It used to be, hey, what are the pharma companies doing this? What we can learn. Now it's beyond that. It's like, what can we learn from McDonald's or Coca-Cola or somebody else? Because a lot of times those principles can apply. We're just trying to help people, you know, help them get healthier.
Well, thank you so much for being with me, Jim. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Emory. Good talking to you.
So up next in April, we'll be talking about our fourth marketing truth: maximize reach to achieve the greatest impact. We'll be talking about creative commitment and how the more people who see your messages, the more effective your campaigns will be. And for those listening, if you have examples of U.S. companies that are doing great effective marketing and want to highlight that, or if you have an opinion on what works or doesn't work, we at WARC are eager to hear from you. I'm Anne-Marie Kerwin, America's editor. The WARC podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Thanks for listening.